Welcome back to Inside Investing. Today, in part two, we continue the conversation with Mike Mayo about the banking system.
Something you talk about, you know, I think in your book, where the CEO of Citigroup in the 1980s wanted to make the company into a growth stock, you know, growing earnings 15% every year. I mean, can you just sort of walk through how that makes sense or doesn't make sense, you know, as something to think about, you know, with a bank?
Well, with the bank, it's very counterintuitive when you try to understand banks, because the goods that banks sell are loans. It's very confusing. And so if I want to sell more goods, I just make more loans. Here, take my money. How hard is that? I mean, it's great for the first year or two, but the real question is, you know, how much loss are you going to have on that money? So that's the issue with banks. So I don't think banks are designed to be growth stocks. They're designed to grow as fast as an economy grows. And hopefully they do this in a prudent way without the types of home lending abuses that took place during the crisis. And it's done sustainably. So you saw in the 1950s and 60s, you saw steady growth. And, you know, the hope is that we'll go back to that sort of slow, steady, and sustainable growth that we had a few decades ago. So it's not going to be exactly like, you know, our father's economies, but, you know, something more akin to that than what we had the last decade.
Gotcha. But also, I mean, to step back a second, there are many types of banks, as I'm sure you know better than I do. And how would you bracket them out? Like, if you were to think about, you know, sort of bright line distinctions between different types of businesses in this particular category, like what are the big, you know, types of categories that you would use?
You know, I'll give you two categories of banks: well-run banks and poorly run banks. And the truth is, a lot of times it's management over model. It really is. So we can find good examples of investment banks and regional banks and money center banks. So there's your three categories I think you were looking for. But I really like to think about which banks, you know, have their act together, which banks, you know, have a clear strategy, that they're executing one with good overseers, a strong board, ideally more skin in the game. Back in a few decades ago, these banks were more owned by the employees and the directors, not so much today. In fact, that was one of my questions at the annual meetings. Will the directors buy more stock? I mean, how do we know the directors' interests are aligned with mine, the shareholder?
Right.
How do we know that? Go ahead, step up to the plate and buy some stock.
Sure.
You know, put your skin in the game. Otherwise, what are you just going there for the free lunches? You get, you know, $100,000, $200,000 a year to sit on some board and be a rubber stamp for a bunch of proposals. So I think we need to change that. So when we talk about categories of banks, you know, let's just see better oversight. Slow and steady actually does win the day in the banking industry.
Yeah, that intuitively makes sense. I mean, and sort of on Bloomberg TV a couple months ago, you said, you know, this is going to be the worst revenue decade for banks since the Great Depression. You know, and that sounds pretty bad. I mean, the Great Depression didn't sound like a great time. What happens in this sort of world to these companies? Are they just, is there nothing to do with these stock prices going to zero? How should investors think if they own a mutual fund that has an allocation to banks or something like that? Are people making mistakes at some level, or what's going on?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The bad news is that this should be the worst revenue growth decade for U.S. banks since the Great Depression, and that's bad. And we're not growing out of our problems the way we did in the 1980s with, you know, lesser developed country, third world debt lending to Brazil and elsewhere. You can't grow through that. You can't grow through your problems as you did in the early 90s with commercial real estate. You're not going to have your foot in the accelerator and see GDP at astronomical rates. And so a consequence of that and having lent so much last decade is much less revenue growth for banks. And here we are, mid-year 2013, and you know how much loans have grown this year? People don't know this. They're down 0.5%. Surprise. And partly because we're still cleaning up from the crisis. You're downsizing a lot of those problem loans. You're not making those new loans. But that's not the sign of an incredibly robust economy from the bottom up. But this doesn't have to all be bad. So I expect much slower growth than in the past. But again, we don't want exceptional growth. So if it allows or encourages banks to get their expenses under control, to allocate their capital better, to be more optimized, you could have slower growth, but if it comes with less risk, then actually valuations can increase. You had higher valuations back in the 50s and the 1960s. So slower growth, if it comes with, you know, stronger balance sheets, more stable earning streams, better oversight, you know, more predictable outcomes, your valuations can go up dramatically, even with that lesser growth. Now, we have to make sure that the industry and specific banks get that memo. They might not get that memo. And you still hear stories of people fighting to get the loan business, and they cut the term, they cut the prices. Again, these are the goods, these are the products they're selling. But at what point are you going to keep cutting your prices? At some point, it's not so economic. It might be economical day one, and you get your fees, mm-hmm. but day two, three, or four, when the losses come in, you go, that doesn't make sense. So we have to watch out for that. But slow growth isn't necessarily...
But you're right. Bad. I mean, if you can grow slowly, I mean, you're managing risk to a point where, you know, analysts can cut their discount rates to some extent, then you're still getting, you know, price appreciation, you're still getting value growth, right? But it's really about managing those risks and not extending yourself out to the points that we've seen before, right? And not, like, competing necessarily on price for every single loan or every single opportunity that's out there. People would be a lot more selective than they have in the past because there's just not as many opportunities either.
And that might be the silver lining of the crisis. I mean, you could have said that after the other crises, but I think society in general has gotten the message more this time. The silver lining could be, you know, let's not try to be all things to all people. Let's not try to have the banking system solve all of society's problems. Maybe home ownership for everybody doesn't make sense in having that be conducted through the banking industry. And if the silver lining is, okay, we're going to stay within the game that we know.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to my golf analogy, it's summer here, but, you know, just stay in the fairway and, you know, just don't mess up. It's a loser's game for the banking industry, too. Just don't mess up. Those are the winners over time.
Yeah, I wonder if I can ask you to sort of talk through something that I hear all the time when we talk about how banks will return to profitability, which is someone will say, can't banks just borrow at the discount window and just lever up and buy a whole bunch of treasury bonds forever, and isn't that just great?
Well, that's an example of the interest rate risk. And if you go ahead and do that, then you're simply a leveraged bond fund. Mm-hmm. You can borrow money from the wholesale markets all the time and buy some securities, and that's great until what happens? The price of those securities tanked, just like sugar tanked in after World War One in 1921, and just like, you know, third world debt tanked in the 1980s, just like commercial real estate tanked the early 1990s, just like home prices tanked, you know, the latter part of last decade. So, yeah, you want to go ahead and do that? I'm glad. Let me know when you become CEO of a bank and borrow a lot of wholesale funds and buy securities. I'll run.
You'll put a sell rating on my stock. Well, then actually that ties right into the next thing I wanted to ask you. Is sort of what is both the smartest thing and the dumbest thing you've ever heard from a bank CEO? And I wonder, I mean, maybe let's just lever up and buy a bunch of treasury bonds is the dumbest thing. But.
I've heard the dumbest thing. One of the dumbest things was from the old CEO of Citigroup. And he said he had a target to grow assets. And you just heard me talk about how easy it is to grow assets. And then I think that was dumb, but what was worse is when they said, well, that's not really a goal. When on the page, in the presentation, that's up on their website.
As the goal.
Like, okay, what am I missing here? Or the doublespeak, oh, it's not a goal. And just, I think they eventually realized that was a mistake. And again, the new management team, the new CEO, you know, that was never mentioned, nothing like that. So that was pretty bad. And the other really stupid thing that I heard was, a bank, it was actually PNC Bank, back in the mid-90s, they pursued an acquisition saying it would cure their interest rate problems.
How like, do you do that through acquisition?
You get some better funding, and they had some explanation. It was just a ridiculous explanation. And I went out with a report saying this is ridiculous. I think shareholders will turn this down. And the shareholders didn't turn it down, but several voted against it, and that management team eventually turned over too, which is pretty remarkable. I mean, individual investors can see these red flags, and I've seen red flags such as when Citigroup wouldn't allow me in for those meetings last decade. That was a red flag. And stock's down 90% since then. Or PNC, after I put my report out, it's a regional bank in the mid-90s. They wouldn't let me in for a couple of years. Now, again, I try to write my reports balanced. Here's the positives and negatives, all that. But that was a red flag, and they had big issues then.
It's but really if something doesn't feel right, trust your gut. It's hard if you don't do this every day to trust your gut. Mm-hmm. But if something doesn't feel right, you have a lot of choices out there. Okay, pass. We'll skip. Let's right. do something else. And you might miss it, and someone says, oh, the stock doubled since then. That's fine, but you're going to miss. It's a loser's game, okay? You're going to give up some upside on some, but as long as you don't have the huge mistakes, you'll wind up better in the end.
Right. So it goes back to what you said before. If you don't understand something, you know, that should keep you away from a business to buying a business, right? If anything, it ever becomes opaque, right? If it's not transparent, becoming more and more opaque, it's harder and harder to get information or answers. That's another red flag, right, for most investors to get away from. And those are things that some people see and some people don't, right? I think the better investors are the ones that see those red flags and can act on them. And, they say, it's not necessarily trusting your gut, because like you said, they're not doing it all the time. But those are pretty apparent signals for investors, I think.
But sometimes it's very obvious. I mean, when my daughter was 4 years old and we're walking around New York City, she goes, why are all these banks here? She had gone bank branches. And this was before the financial crisis. I mean, it's a fair question.
Right.
Okay, a 4 or 5 year old asks a question, and it just makes sense. In fact, they did away with the ice cream store, and they changed it into a local bank here.
Didn't compete. I didn't turn into a local bank.
Yeah, no, so that was a sign of the top, I'm telling you.
Yeah, yeah.
So sometimes it's not as tough to trust your gut as you might realize. It's just the obvious observation is sometimes all you need.
And so, I mean, like, I think we've talked about, we've sort of made fun of some bank CEOs just now. I mean, and there are a number of instances of people sort of mocking the managements of these companies into the financial crisis. And I wonder, is that sort of because they're just sort of not suited to it, or is it because in part they may have kind of an impossible task in some senses? I mean, how do you respond to the thought that it might be impossible to run one of these massive banks?
There's always information risk with any investment that you have, period, right? It's just a matter of, how much information that you can get. And to some degree, banks are a little more opaque than other investments because you have, thousands upon thousands of loans in a portfolio that an investor can't possibly know about. But you can go ahead and look at the historical track record. You can read about what kind of processes they have in place. You can read about the oversight. You can read about what kind of incentives they have to get it right. So while you might not know everything about everything that's on the balance sheet, you can have some sense on how they do their business. And you can look at, I'll start back to the annual reports. How has the strategy changed or not changed? So one bank, Wells Fargo, I look back at their annual report from 15 years ago, and I look at their annual report today, and it sure looks pretty similar. So that gives me a lot of confidence that they're not trying exotic new activities. Mm. Back then it was called Norwest, now it's Wells Fargo. And I literally compare the two, and it's like, wow, this is really amazing. On the other hand, you look at Citigroup's annual reports for the last decade, even before the crisis, you go, wow, they're kind of changing it every year. How can I get comfortable with this? So you might not be able to drill down as much as other industries, but you can drill down far enough to get a pretty good sense. Again, the financial targets at banks, that's a leading indicator. In fact, I looked at the financial targets for last decade, and the banks that were looking for some of the fastest growth had some of the worst performance, like Citigroup, which was looking to double their earnings every 4 or 5 years last decade. They were the worst. Wells Fargo had one of the slower growth targets, and they performed the best.
Makes some sense. On the same cover of the same report that we've been sort of talking about, you are smashing a gigantic piggy bank up into multiple parts. I wonder if you could sort of outline why that might make sense and sort of some scenarios for how it might materialize as reality.
So that was a cartoon.
Yeah, a cartoon.
Highlighting that. In fact, my young daughter got upset about that. Like, make the piggy bank look more like a piggy bank and not a pig, or something like that. But the idea was break up the banks.
And I wanted to raise awareness to the idea that if Plan A does not pan out, and Plan A is the strategy as described in the annual reports. So in the case of Citigroup, if you go back and look back in 1998 and look at their targets, or if you look at J.P. Morgan or Bank America and Citigroup in particular, if you look at the premise in which these companies were created, that is, they're going to have economies of scale, which means more efficient. They're going to have revenue synergies, which means more revenues. They're going to have diversification, which means less risky. If you look at the original assumptions for creating these banks and look at how it's played out for the last 10 or 15 years, you realize that the three largest banks versus the rest of the banking industry are less efficient, have less revenue growth, they have more risk, they have more earnings volatility, they have lower returns on assets, lower returns on equity, lower valuations, and worse stock price performance. So what are we talking about here? What question would you have after that? Only one question, and that is, so what are we going to do about it? And when I say what are we going to do about it, I'm not talking about the government, I'm not talking about regulators, they have their own agendas. I'm talking about are we as investors going to do about it? So buying 100 shares of stock in the four companies, you know, I can now say, what are you going to do with my money? You haven't given me a good return for the last 10 to 15 years. What are you doing differently? What is your plan B? Because if plan A hasn't panned out, and it hasn't panned out, you know, in spades, then how are you going to restructure the company? How are you going to allocate your capital better? How are you going to sell off businesses? How are you going to cut costs? How are you return some of that capital back to me, the shareholder, to give me a better return? It's my right. I own the company. So that's the idea behind this. And so if the large banks don't succeed on their plans now, now that we're in a more stable world where the housing crisis isn't so much a crisis anymore with lingering effects, while we haven't been growing so quickly, while there's no blow-ups, now we have the luxury to look back and say, how can we run these banks better? And if we need to break them up, let's break them up. And if you can achieve the results without breaking them up, fantastic. But it's my money. Give me plan B. Break up the banks if you're not confident, or if you haven't made me confident enough with plan A.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, are you worried at all that, you know, if you have, let's say, you know, you have these various financial supermarkets where, you know, an individual investor, say, can just go and, you know, get comfortable with one large financial institution and receive the vast majority of their services from that one institution. You know, is there a worry, and to what extent is there a worry, and this is sort of a question for both of you guys, that it might be harder to select these service providers in an environment where there are fewer very big, strong brand names where you can just sort of opt into one service?
Well, that is a concern, the idea that the largest banks are too big to fail, and that it's one-stop shopping, but when they run into problems, then what? Mm. And so the issue for the government is if you have too big to fail firms, how do you make them pay a little bit extra? And you're seeing that there's an effective tax on the largest banks through higher capital ratios. But if I'm an investor and you're dealing with one of the too big to fail banks, you probably can sleep a little more easily. Sorry, that's the way the world works right now, okay? So if you have your money with a J.P. Morgan or Bank of America or Citigroup, it's I think it's safer. Okay, I said it, okay?
Yeah.
But it's true. And if you're at a small community bank and they fail, you don't have that same luxury of comfort. Now, having said that, I love a lot of community banks. I think the service is fantastic at times. So just if you have your money with a small bank, you get higher rates, just make sure you understand why, because sometimes, you know, higher returns means higher risk, and you just want to make sure that's not the case.
Yeah, I mean, if we sort of pivot to, you know, regulation, there's a great anecdote in your book about the officials at the Office of Thrift Supervision referring to banks as customers in the mid-2000s. You know, and these are the guys who are supposed to be mining the store, right? So has that environment changed at all? I mean, is the SEC still thinking of these banks as their customers?
Oh, boy. How are we going to make our world better for our kids, huh? Holy cow. I mean, that's not capitalism, is it? The people overseeing the industry, you know, they are customers. And then you have the revolving door where the regulators go into private industry and cash out, kind of delayed payment, so to speak. So I think that's just terrible. In my book, I talk about this. I was kind of summoned to see the head of New York Bank Regulation. This was in the around 2002, 2003. And she wanted to hear about my views in the banking industry. And at the end of the meeting, she's walking me out. She goes, "Well, I suppose the banks might listen more to what you have to say because you make their stock prices move." And I was thinking, going into the meeting, "Wow, here's somebody who's actually overseeing the banks, making sure they're doing what's right." So I was looking to regulators to oversee the industry, and she was looking to the markets to oversee the industry. And at that moment, I realized nobody was minding the store. There's no adults in the room. And I think the regulators are trying to change. You're always looking in the rearview mirror, resolving problems. And to tell you the truth, I wrote research on this. The degree of leverage in the banking industry was higher than it had been in 25 years before the financial crisis in 2007. And I presented this to a group of regulators in Washington, D.C. This is before the financial crisis. And they go, "Wow, where did you get that data?" And I go, "Well, it's from the FDIC website." It's how you present it. I looked at tangible equity plus reserves, and it's like the worst in 25 years before the financial crisis. So now the industry has doubled its capital level. It's increased liquidity by 50%. Some of the worst performing banks are away. Regulators are more on the scene. But I'm still not convinced the incentives have been completely fixed. And if you just look at the revolving door, I mean, you're still incentivized, meaning you can make a lot of money if you're a tough regulator and then you switch the other side. And so that's just one of many ongoing conflicts that I think is still the root of the issues today, and that was the root of the issues with the financial crisis. And it's not just talking about compensation of senior bank managers. It's how regulators are compensated. It's how accounting firms are compensated. It's the incentive you have to go ahead and let's make sure this bank likes me so they can help me with my career down the road. I mean, there's so many conflicts that the individual investor hasn't even thought about or that I probably didn't realize having been in this industry 25 years.
Yeah, I mean, so if you were to point to someone who actually may be in charge, are there clear agents like the SEC, the Fed that are mining the store? Where are the cops supposed to be?
Well, that's the issue. The way you describe the problem is the issue. Mm-hmm. Right? You have the Federal Reserve, which I think I'm biased. I worked there back in the late '80s, but I think they are the best. I mean, that's, you know, if you're in finance, you're an economist, that's the place to be. I still think, but again, I'm biased. But you talk to people, but you have the Fed. You have the SEC. You have other bank regulators like the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. You have the FDIC. You have the commodities, you know, CFTC. And you have all these other regulators. You have so many different regulators. Everybody's responsible. Nobody's accountable. Too many regulators. It's ridiculous. And they've tried to change this over the years. And then when you try to change this, the agencies that's under threat, and they get some allies, and they fight back, and it's just too many. And so I don't mind, you know, some duplication, but it's too much. Oh, and then you have states. States get in on the act. And actually all this helps to reduce the risk to some degree, but it also increases the risk to investors because you're still coming out with new rules. I mean, the whole Dodd-Frank Act, I mean, the spirit of it was fine, but I can't understand it. I've been doing this job 25 years. I don't really understand. The Volcker rule, Paul Volcker is one of my heroes. I talk about that in the book, but originally I think he just wanted it to be a couple pages. And it goes on and on and on. I don't understand it. So if you can't understand it, how do people work in these firms completely understand it? You're going to need a lawyer next to your trading desk to know what you can do and what not do. I like principle-based regulation. In other words, you can't make it general. And if it's a little bit vague, well, if you go outside the bounds and mess up, that's a little more power to the regulators. They'll enforce it. And so this, you know, the Ten Commandments fits on one page. So I'm not convinced the regulatory environment is where it should be.
We don't have the clarity like that we should. We have so many different people competing for attention. A lot of times it's politics, not economics. So it's a little disappointing from when I worked at the Fed in the late 1980s. That was in the wake of the Paul Volcker era. Yeah, you felt like you were really doing public service. I felt like I didn't need or want to be anywhere else at the time. I write about this in the book, but it was the wake and the end of the Cold War when I grew up in the 70s, and you weren't at war anymore, and now you had kind of the economic survival of our country during the banking crisis. And you felt proud going to work, and you weren't thinking about any revolving doors. I didn't see people at the Fed going through revolving doors at that time, and there was a real sense of pride and honor and duty, and those aren't words that you've used in conjunction with regulation any time in recent history, unfortunately. But I think they're trying to go back there. There's people like, Tom Honig at the FDIC. Even if I disagree with some of his views, that's someone who's made in that mold. So there's still some dedicated public servants around, and we should all, give them their due credit.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Mike, for being with us here. This is Inside Investing.
Thank you.
Copyright 2013 CFA Institute.